Welcome to This Is Your Afterlife. I'm Dave Marr. I'm a comedian who survived a coma, and this is my podcast. And today, I'm talking to Jeff Weiss. Jeff is a... I struggle with the most basic shit sometimes, like how to define a person via the form of introduction.
Traveling Bible salesman.
Traveling Bible salesman? Okay, yeah, right. The Bible of what? The Ten Crack Commandments or some shit like that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But like most reductively, it would be like rap music journalist probably, right?
I like to just say writer, honestly, because like I feel like, you know, you do something when you're young and it kind of sticks with you. And I don't even write about music, honestly, that much anymore. But I mean, obviously the website I run is hip hop centric, although we kind of, you know, our last two pieces were about a folk artist and Olivia Rodrigo and a jazz artist before that. So I just think, you know, obviously, like I love rap music, but it's just one of the many facets of the stuff that I'm interested in. It just so happened that it was a way to kind of, I mean, I love it and I care about it. And a lot of what I've covered is that. So, I mean, any guesses and any statement is as good as the next, I think.
Well, for my purposes, you are the writer of the, I'm a sucker for a manifesto.
I've had a lot of those in my day. Yeah.
You have written a lot of manifestos in your day?
Yeah, I'm a manifesto kind of guy, I think.
what is a manifesto kind of guy? Like, I know what it means for me, but like for me, it's like I just feel the need to constantly be like, okay, now I have completely figured myself out. This is the thing I'm going to project to the world forever. And I'm sticking by it. And then, of course, it changes 6 months later. What's your version of a manifesto guy, though?
I mean, it just depends because it's like whatever emotion or idea is like ensnaring me at the time will then kind of lead to whatever manifesto I'll unspool. But I mean, the one you're referring to was sort of about journalism. And I've been a journalist and, you know, I wrote a book that's called Waiting for Britney Spears that's technically nonfiction or sold as nonfiction, but it's like a hybrid of a novel.
Yeah.
And obviously I was inspired by a lot of the new journalists that are sort of bending the rules between, you know, conventional journalism and kind of narrative fiction. So this particular manifesto we're talking about was sort of connected to the relaunch of my website, POW Mag, that I've been running on and off, well, on for the last two decades. And we
Since
relaunched
2005, right?
Yeah, that was the initial screeds were in 2005.
Okay, but this is the Blogspot era was 2005?
Very Blogspot era. And it was just me and it was just misanthropic. And it was just very much like a way for me to kind of, I was very much immersed in the Waiting for Britney Spears era of my life. And I needed sort of a creative outlet for what I was working on a novel at the time that, you know, is now in my desk drawer next to me. But the blog sort of started out of that and then eventually became kind of, it found its own way. I mean, I generally think creative projects kind of find their own path and they become what they want to be. And there's only so much you can do to control it. Or if you're smart, I mean, I don't know. But then again, like I'm not Theo Vaughn or Joe Rogan or something. Not like that's like a good thing that I want to be, but no one is like paying me $40 million a year from
yes,
a big.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay.
So, yeah. But
gotcha,
I'm sure even those guys would probably tell you that they had no idea what the fuck they were doing. I'm a big believer in not knowing what the fuck you're doing and just like going off your instincts.
Yeah, I would say those guys could stand to like maybe check in with people a little bit on what the fuck they're doing a little bit more.
Need their political advice, I think.
Yeah, right. Exactly. We're talking purely like the machinery of getting a media conglomerate up and running, basically.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I just need like a mullet or something. I think that might help, you know?
The blog, the sort of, and what POW stands for is Passion of the Weiss, right?
It was Passion of the Weiss. Yeah,
right, but it's done one of those things where now the acronym isn't even an acronym. It's just three letters sort of things, right?
But, you know, it has its own meaning for me. I feel like you have to kind of derive a meaning of
yes, what, okay.
So it's like obviously POW is also means prisoner of war.
Mm-hmm.
I feel very much like being a writer or any creative person in the 21st century feels like you're being a creative but prisoner in a hostile society, and you're constantly trying to break out of this kind of trap that, whether it's the tech companies or whether it's just a kind of functionally literate society that, you know, has been engendered by tech and mm-hmm. post-literacy, you're constantly trying to break out of these like prisms and boxes that have been placed in front of you. So I kind of find myself a prisoner of war. So, and
I wasn't even going to make you explain your personal connection, but I'm grateful to hear it.
Anyways, yeah, you're the
you
first
don't feel like you're giving up the ghost of what your own personal meaning is for it.
I don't care. I'm a writer, man, and it's like it's all gonna go into the ether. You know, I've kind of given up the hope of posterity in some way, which mm-hmm. I guess is a natural thing. You know, I just think that there's so much information. I think when you're young, I think you dream about writing things or creating things or whatever for the notion that maybe someone will discover in 30 years. And not to say it's not true, because I think, like, obviously there'll probably be like really bright, weird kids in 30 years from now that'll like be digging into the digital archive or whatever, mm-hmm. or the physical archive. I'm a big fan of physical media for that reason, because I just think I've just watched like everything, all these words become kind of a series of broken 404 links that I've written. So I'm determined to kind of fight against that. And that sort of, that sort of became, you know, one of the seven tertiary interpretations of my existence is kind of this prisoner of war thing where you're, but I'm not a fatalist. I'm always trying to figure out some kind of scheme to break out. You know what I mean? If I was like trapped in like some kind of like awful, like Hunaway Hilton type prison, I would probably be always trying to figure out, you know, some way to get like a spoon to dig through the brick, the mortar, and, you know, get out. I'm just one of these people that if there's a way, if there's like a brick wall I want to run, I want to figure out a way to run through it to get to the other side.
Totally. I mean, if nothing else, just to entertain yourself. If you're going to spend a lifetime in this prison, you got to give yourself a goal, create some narratives around what this time is.
Well, yeah, I guess that's like being a writer, I suppose, is sort of like trying to impose some meaning on the meaningless. You know, it's easy to find life kind of, and I've definitely had phases of my life where it was completely nihilistic and what's the point, you know, like nothing matters, you know, but I don't think that's necessarily a healthy framework to kind of exist. And I don't think it necessarily leads you to being happy. I think it just leads to kind of either idle hedonism or depression or cynicism to the point of where you can't really have joy. So I try to kind of work my way around that and try to find some meaning somehow.
Yeah.
Some way.
Well, the manifesto that I was kind of referring to earlier was it was like the relaunch of POW Mag.
Yeah.
And you were describing, by the way, am I saying your last name right? It's not like a German with a V Vice.
No. I'm sure it was. Something. They exiled us to the Eastern most parts of the Pale of Settlement. But yeah.
But I will link, I'll link it in the description of this episode. But I just loved it, man. And it just was like my familiarity with you is, I've just paid attention to music journalism for most of my life, since like being a kid who was downloading stuff in junior high and high school, you know, and then discovering Pitchfork and that kind of shit. And that was writing news for Pitchfork was my like first job out of college.
I didn't know that. That's cool. What years were you writing news for them?
It was the Mark Richardson, previous guest of this show, was the...
He's the best.
I love him. It was the managing editor, and Scott Plagenhoff was the head honcho of
Scott's
the
great. Editor. Yeah, I didn't work. I didn't. I think I was not there freelancing at the time. I think
it's like 2006 to 2008, basically.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, so like the kind of the glory days of Pitchfork, kind of.
Still in Chicago. Yeah. So, but it's, you know, I had all sorts of like, I didn't know I didn't realize how good of a first job out of college it was. I thought that like being a kind of active alcoholic, anytime they were like, hey man, you shouldn't have like assumed that Rhymefest was going to pay for the second bottle of champagne that you ordered. I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm like 22.
Jesus walks.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, so I'm aware of like other outlets following writers. I know your name, and yeah. I recognize that in the, what I'm calling the manifesto, when you talk about like getting to things first in hip hop culture, being the first among the first people to cover certain artists, to yeah. break certain like actual real life fucking, not just stories, but like murder cases, and launching the careers of good writers and other journalists. I like recognize that as true. I'm like, okay, yeah. And then I click through, I read the manifesto. And I'm self-conscious about over. I know you don't like claim this is a manifesto, but I'm just like, it feels that way to me. It's only complimentary that I mean it.
Okay, yeah. I mean, hey, eloquent diatribe, you know.
sure.
You know, wandering tangent, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. No, manifesto has like force to it. So I'll keep it there.
My 72 thesis is tacked up to the Wittenberg Church, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Wasn't it 95?
I think you're right. I'm Googling that.
Lopping off 23 theses.
92. Yeah, cut that. I'm Martin Luther isn't what it used to be.
Yeah. But you're like talking about this and you're talking about how frustrating it is to be engaging with pop culture, with culture in general, and being a person who just wants to, like, on the simplest level, engage with cool shit and make cool shit sincerely and earnestly. And I know there's, like, a lot of, you know, if we're getting very, like, critical theory about it, authenticity is a very thorny subject. But if we're talking about, like, on a real, like, make the zine, get it to someone's hands level, that's the authenticity that it feels like you're grappling with.
I feel like authenticity, it's like the famous Potter Stewart definition of obscenity. It's like, you know, when you see it, you know what I mean? And not to say that I'm like the most authentic person or whatever. I mean, that's like not for me to judge, but I try to be sincere. I mean, obviously like everybody bullshits. Everyone has to lie sometimes. Everyone has to create a facade or a myth to go about life, but I try to keep it as true as I can to kind of who I am, you know. And maybe that's like, you know, there's the famous Didion quote about we tell ourselves stories in order to live. So maybe that's the story I'm telling myself in order to live. But
well, I'm telling the same story. So.
Yeah, I just like want to do good work and like survive and like pay my bills and
I'd like weirdly to. That's become the hardest fucking thing in the world to do.
Yeah. No, it's. I mean, it's. You have to compromise it so much now. And I know the way to like the way to do it is gossip. It's everything is gossip. It's like there's a famous Truman Capote quote where he's like, all literature is gossip. And I use that in my book. But everything is gossip now. Like, I mean, if you listen to a podcast, they are all gossiping, like Wendy Williams. They were all like, even the news is like the political news is just gossip. It's just like you don't actually know anything. You don't want reporting. You want takes. And takes are so fucking boring to me. They just are. And like, I'm obviously filled with takes. Like, I like a take. You know what I mean? But not everything needs a take. Like, you shouldn't. Like, I know this one guy that I like will not be named, but like I went to high school with him and we're no longer friends. And like he like went into the magosphere. But it's like no matter what the crisis is, like, oh, you are always an expert on riparian rights in the state of Hormuz, the Strait of Hormuz. It's like, motherfucker, you don't know any of these things. You don't know any of these things. You don't know like homelessness policy or drug policy or like the failures inherent in it. Like, you are not an expert on anything, but like you can pontificate and there are just people like that, you know, and that's like a new class of person. And you know, obviously if someone gets me on a podcast, I have a lot to say, but even my own podcast, I'm like, I'm trying not to, like, you know, it's just like I like to interview interesting people and like ask them like questions that I find hopefully will reveal something deeper about themselves or the art or the time that we live in without having to be like, oh, what was your relationship like with like this Instagram model, 3 million followers that like tweeted, you know what I mean? It's just, it's so embarrassing. And like, we just don't have any dignity as a society. Not to say I'm the most dignified person.
No, but I think the fact that you're, that you want that and that you make that, what I tell, the story I tell myself, because it's the same thing I'm doing with this podcast, which is, this is your afterlife. I was in a coma, you know, you come, and perhaps listeners at this point are already sick of me like grappling with the like concept of the podcast several hundred episodes in, but I'm like, it's not about death. It is, I want to talk about death. I'm curious about death, but I'm curious about like death as it relates to life, how it affects life, and the ways in which, for me, this coma was like a clear demarcation point, right? And there are all sorts of deaths. And I know like the thing that I was kind of like projecting onto seeing your, you know, starting as like a tabloidy sort of journalist and having these different phases of even your like music journalism career, I was like, man, I bet you also feel like you've lived several different lives.
Like at least half a dozen.
Yeah.
And I hope to live like 10 more,
sure,
you know?
Totally.
Like I'm a big believer in, not to cut you off, but it's I think that's like, it goes back to what you were saying initially, where you're like, I know you, I think, as like this, and I'm really pleased. I think that like, hopefully I'm not like obviously some kind of like real famous person, but like people sometimes will know me for one thing or the other. And like that to me is like makes me happy when they're like, oh yeah, I knew like this one thing a million years ago. And that's kind of what I thought of you as. And then you're doing this thing. And it's not necessarily the best for like money. Cause I think like, to make money, I think the best thing, and like, to be fair, like that, like probably on some level, like that's why I've been able to survive is because people know me as like, you're like LA hip hop, and people be like, we need an essay on like Kendrick Lamar and the Pop Out, and fine. Like, you know what? It's some magazine that like not that many people will read, but they have some like munificent benefactor,
right,
well, to be able to do something thoughtful that will allow me to do something that is kind of more risky or less popular. Like I'm glad to do it. Like, I mean, for me, I'm like I said at the beginning, we need to find a way out of jail. So I'm like, kind of like without, you know, hurting people or being a part of the problem. I mean, I'm sure people would say that I'm a part of the problem. I'm sure that people always hate people. But I would like to not be part of the problem. You know, I'd like to kind of make things a little bit better. Well, there's an airplane we might want to.
I'm okay with the airplane.
Might want to just pause.
Can be verite.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Fine. Yeah. So, I've shot enough documentaries where like the cameraman are like, hold on, airplane.
You know, well, for me, it's just like there's a certain level of audio perfection that I can't seek or expect people to have every time because I do not have the resources of time to be able to
totally
edit that way, you know? So it's like, but I guess that's what I'm excited and curious about is like, you know, I have through different mediums of performing, you know, put a lot into this podcast. And I'm like, and it feels like a thing that I just want people to hear. And actually, after reading the piece that you wrote to relaunch POW, I started offering people, because at the end of it, you were like, by the way, if you can't afford a subscription, reach out and we'll give you a free one. Like no one's going to starve. And I was like, oh yeah, I should just like, if I'm making these weird other little shows on the Patreon, I should just give people free subscriptions to the Patreon if I can. You know what I mean? And like,
Or just like you got to jump through like a hoop.
like, sure. Right,
paragraph. You know what I mean?
Yes, like, yes.
Like I'm a big believer in like, you know, you have to have some kind of like, cause people will take advantage, right? That's like the paradox of life, right? Where you're like, I want to be generous and kind and help whoever I can.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also motherfuckers will take advantage of you in a heartbeat. Yeah. And it's like, hey, I don't know. It's but I agree. I mean, like if some college kid is like, hey, I really like it. I like, I can't have no money. I'm like, dude, whatever, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not even paywalled yet. I mean, I don't want to paywall anything ever. I think information wants to be free is a stupid idea because it doesn't. But, and also like bad information wants to be free. Like, that's the problem. Like, good information requires reporting and time and research and like thoughtfulness. Then that like is time, because we do live in a capitalist society whether we want to or not. So I don't know. But yeah, bad information wants to be free. TikTok is always going to be free. That's fucking bad information. Like, I, you know, and I'm sure there are like thoughtful, like real, but like, I don't trust TikTok. I don't trust anything on TikTok because like, and I come of this of somebody that like is a reported, like I've reported a lot of things and I've probably gotten a lot of things wrong. Like, I don't know, like, you know, I don't know what I got wrong.
Intentionally. Yeah. Yeah.
No. Yeah. But I know how hard it is to get things right. And that's the thing. And it's like, yeah, you actually probably need a couple editors. You probably actually need a fact checker. You probably actually need to go out and speak to people rather than like use your genius brain that only you can see. But I mean, that's just what it is, right? It's just, it's really like, it's all a charisma and personality cults. And I don't know, somebody said the other day, they're like, you should just do that shit. Like, they're like, you're charismatic, you can do it. And I was like, yeah, I don't like that though. I find cults boring. I also like, I'm not like, couldn't get me in a cult. Like, yeah. I just doesn't compute. I'm like, why would I listen to this idiot? He knows. It's like, your podcast is death. I'm like, all right, yeah, if you know the answer to it, I'll maybe listen. If you're the only person in the history of time, like, that has ever come, like, you know what I mean? Like, I think about this all the time. I'm like, man, like, all these people couldn't come back. Like, amazing people. Like I think about, like, Albert Camus, right? And I'm like, he died at, like, in his 40s, I think, or early 50s, in a car crash. And you're like, yeah, Albert Camus won the Nobel Prize. He wrote The Stranger. He wrote, like, you know, he wrote amazing, amazing literature. And he just died in a car accident. And he couldn't come back. You know what I mean? So who am I to think that if I, you know, just, like, I say him because that just strikes me as one of those fucked up arbitrary deaths where I think, yeah, Albert Camus probably had a lot more to offer the world, and he was just gone and couldn't figure out a way to come back from the grave. So,
well, then rather than like return to any threads that we've already got open, I will dive right in and ask you my first big question.
Okay.
What do you hope happens when you die?
So this is like, everything is like tenfold for me, because I never have a simple answer, you know, but I mean, I don't, first of all, I guess I don't want to die. Like, I'm very much, I really like life.
Yeah.
I don't get suicide, not because I don't want to disrespect anyone that has committed suicide. I understand that, like, my own life is constantly filled with pain and suffering, like everybody else's, right? And it's the first world Buddhism. But I don't know, I like it. Like, are you, like, I look for suicide, I'm like, you're not curious to see how this shit's gonna go? I mean, like, I get it if you're like 75 years old and you're like, all right, my next 20 years are gonna be just filled with like blistering pain. But young people do it. I'm like, I'm, no disrespect. Like, if that is your choice, then, you know, who I understand, like, I'm living in a relatively comparatively privileged perspective. So I obviously can't understand it, and I don't pretend to, but I'm just so curious. I was having this conversation like the other day, you know, I was like thinking about this, and I don't know. I could live forever if I, you know, if I could stay my own age, like right now, maybe like when I was young enough to play basketball still, but like stupid. I mean, maybe I always was stupid, but yeah, like if I could like stay my age now and play basketball the way I did when I was like 22 years old,
okay,
I would be fine to live forever. You know, that would be great. I would read every book that I wanted to read, which I don't have enough time for 10 lifetimes. Like, I would just, you know, could read Ulysses in 200 years from now and be just fine. I could read Infinite Jest in 300. I could watch all of Fellini's films, even the bad ones. You know, it'd be amazing. And, you know, I could write. It would take me probably, I think, like in 200 years, I could be the writer I want to be. You know,
okay,
I'm about 200 years away from being good enough to like be like, all right, that's where I'll come. You know,
that's a nice, like, realistic timeline to give yourself.
I'd be pretty good in 200 years. I'd figure it all out. You know, I could learn enough of the words. I could memorize all of the concepts. I could finally figure out what Wittgenstein is talking about. You know, like,
that's the big obstacle for you, is figure out Wittgenstein, and then you'll crack.
Well, it's just like, I hate when people, like, that's like my thing. It's like, there's a couple like pet peeves I have, one of which of writers is like, oh, when you're quoting Kant or something and you're like, oh, okay, you're so smart, you understand. Like, shut up. Like, you don't, like, no one reads Kant like anymore. Like, there's like 12 philosophy students that do, and that's great for them. But like, you're just doing that to sound smart.
Your pet peeve is the quoting of Kant or the making fun of the quoting of Kant?
No, I think it's when people like writers like attempt to be like sophisticated, like, okay, that like are like kind of pop culture writers, but then they're they're like pick me pop culture writers, but they're like, okay, I know Kant. Come on. No, you don't. Or like you do, but like shut up. It's not applicable. It's give me like, you can, come on, maybe Sartre or something, but just, you know, it's, anyways. But yeah, I think, there's just so much out there. I get bored like when I'm watching like a Zoom, you know, where like someone is talking to me and like I'm like in a Zoom call and I'm like, why am I doing this with my life? I like went off on some poor person like last week just because I was like, man, I don't want to be here and you're not asking me good questions. I'm gone. I don't normally do that. It's really mean. I shouldn't have done that, but I'm going to die. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, I'd rather read a book for 30 minutes. Like, I have like so many journal entries I want to write that I don't write. That's why I need to live to be 300. And I would like also a memory pill so I could remember things more clearly.
Okay. Yeah.
Because I feel like I'm losing RAM. Like I'm out of RAM. Like, if we ran into each other in like 2 years from now, you'd have to be like, Jeff, it's Dave. We did a podcast for like 3 hours and we had like these deep innermost, and I'd be like, yes, of course, Dave. And like, but I wouldn't recognize you. I would like then remember everything we talked about, and I remember everything you told me, and I remember this whole process, but I wouldn't remember your face because I'm out of RAM.
I think that's fine though. If all you need is one little kick to remember everything, that's,
I just want more RAM, Dave.
Yeah, I get that, dude. RAM.
Yeah, like not the good Paul McCartney album from the early 70s.
Right.
Yeah, more the Daft Punk style of RAM. But yeah, I would be really happy. I think, I don't know, it makes me sad, death. Like, that's the only thing where I think about like AI, where I'm like, I don't know, maybe they can find some way to give me like, live to be like, I mean, I don't know. But then, you know, I spend a lot of time with my grandmother who's 96 years old.
Yeah.
I was with her yesterday. I'm with her every Saturday if I can. It's really brutal and painful. I asked Gary Snyder once, you know, about aging, because he was like at the time like 85, and he was just like, and now he's 95, and he was like, I can't even tell you. He's like, you'll just see when you get there, which is kind of a Buddhist, you know, Zen thing to say for him. But yeah, it is just, I'm in my grandmother's home like every Saturday, you know, and it's a really, I mean, I forget who said it, but old age isn't a battle, it's a massacre. You know?
Okay.
And I hope that that's like the only thing I think like maybe is possible with AI. Not like I know anything about it, but I think that's what they're selling us.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Like, you can live forever broke and enslaved.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Yeah,
but
yeah,
like,
yeah.
But you can live forever. But I don't know. Yeah. I really would like that. I mean, if I hope that there's an afterlife, I think like, I don't know, you can go to like, I can like see the Grateful Dead like for free. And, you know, and like they're all there, you know,
your life now, but with just like access to different musical acts.
I can like go see Miles Davis's like second quintet.
Yeah.
You know, and then like, I don't know, I can go to whatever restaurant I want and they don't charge me. And all the people I loved. I mean, I miss people a lot. You know, I really think about death constantly. I feel I've always been like this, though. I've always been a very like, death affects me very profoundly in a way where I feel like these people are sort of like patron saints watching over me. I've had some kind of, to paraphrase Ghostface, crazy visions, you know, and I don't necessarily think like, I don't know. It felt like my ancestors were talking to me from the grave on ayahuasca, but who am I to say, but I'll take it. You know, I mean, they, they said to keep going, that they're proud of me. That made me really happy.
Were there specific ancestors?
Yeah, they were pretty boring mostly. Yeah, that's what I talked to my grandfather, who's dead, and he was very boring still.
And what do you mean?
I never could have a conversation with him when he was alive. So, I mean, maybe it was just continuing the trend. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I miss a lot of people, and that would be really nice to be reunited with them. I think that would make me really happy. Like, I mean, Draco, my friend Lucas Foster, who was a really brilliant writer that died of a drug overdose at like 28. My friend Joe Shin died like, I guess, 2016. It was 2016 or 17. And he was this brilliant writer that never got a chance to kind of, he just wasn't built for this world. He would have been probably discovered in his 20s, and someone would have plucked him out of obscurity and given him a book deal, and maybe that would have saved him, or maybe he would have kept on drinking himself into oblivion. But there's not really a way to make it as a writer unless you're sort of one of these people that's like careerist and going to an MF. You know, you have to.
Yeah.
I mean, the only way to make it as a writer anymore is you get an MFA and you teach. And that sucks. Because, I mean, props to everyone that is doing it. Like, I literally with one of my best friends who is a teacher at a school. She's creative writing. And I am totally envious of his life in some degree, because he makes like low six figures to teach. And he can get summers off, and he has I mean, that sounds great. And maybe I'm a fool for not doing that, because
Those jobs in academia are fucking dead at this point.
Again, it's... And this is nothing against anybody that is doing it, because of course, but what are you telling these kids? Because I talk to young kids all the time, like you're not, there's nothing. No one reads anymore. That's like, that was my problem with my book when I got, you know, I got off the road, and look, I was really happy with the reception my book got. I wouldn't change anything.
The Britney Spears book.
Yeah, it got really good reviews. People seemed to really like it. I met a bunch of really interesting people on the road. Like, I connected with people. It was a really profound and meaningful experience that I wouldn't trade for anything in the world. But ultimately, it's kind of frustrating, because it just, I don't think people read. That I know people read, obviously, like I know that, but I really don't think, like, mass literacy, like, people, you can't beat TikTok, you can't beat Instagram, you can't beat, like, the mound of emails that people have to return every day.
Right. Okay. So this is the thing that I'm, like, interested in.
Yeah.
You know, to return to a thread that is like also very present in me, I don't have plans to turn this into a video podcast anytime soon. Yeah. The thing I enjoy editing is audio. The thing I enjoy listening to is audio. And I listen to full podcasts. And so I'm like, I just am. Now, the thing I've done is the thing I associate with Steve Albini of, like, I'm going to put things on parallel tracks where I can make whatever I want, and I am not going to put any load bearing weight on it for making me a living. I'll just do other shit to make a living. And you're, you know, in writing about the relaunch of POW, you're like, this is what we're doing. I believe in this, the kind of work. And it's basically like, you know, you and I are like, people don't seem to consume things this way, the way I like. But I also think, and I imagine you have this too, of like, well, if I like these things, there's no way I'm that unique. Other people like this shit too.
So totally. But
do you go about like doubling down on, and even like, I mean, you're, correct me if I'm wrong, but like staking some of your living on the fact that like people want the kind of non-overworked version of this stuff that you also like?
Yeah, I have to believe there are people out there, and like I will probably die trying, you know, to find them. I have to believe it, because otherwise I don't know how I would. I don't want to quit. I want to contribute and make the world better, to keep on being redundant about it, but like, or at least I feel like it's all dying. That's the thing. I feel it really is all dying. And I've been saying this for a long time, and everyone's like, no, you're crazy. The XYZ, this person did this. And no, but it's dying. And there are no, like, there's Pitchfork, and great. Those are my friends.
Yeah.
I love them. But there needs to be more than just Pitchfork. Mm-hmm. I know Sarah Gum is out there, Aquarium Drunkard's out there. You know, there are still, Rolling Stone still exists. You know, there are places doing it, but I feel, you know, I came up like doing blogs like a billion years ago and they're all dead with the exception of Aquarium Drunkard and Sarah Gum. And I never would have expected like Fader and Vice would basically be like essentially dead. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, not that they still exist, but like they're not like the place they were in like, you know, 10 years ago or whatever. Yeah, you know, yeah. No Fader Board at South by Southwest. They're not really South by Southwest. Like these are things that I just don't understand how like they disappear, you know? And I understand that you can't bring things back from the grave in the set. You can't like exhume somebody and reconstitute them. But like, I do believe these ideas are kind of immutable, that we want these things. And I think that's like what you're talking about. It's like, don't people want something a little bit smarter or hopefully more nuanced? Maybe I'm wrong. I don't expect like the average, you know, 16-year-old to like want sure. to read a 2,000-word takedown of fake Mink or whatever, but I don't know.
But you're also like, if someone were to be like, Jeff, we'd like to pitch you an audience of the average 16-year-old. You're like, actually, I'm okay with like, I'll take like the weird 16-year-olds. Maybe.
Yeah, there. You know? Yeah, that's the thing. There always are going to be, and I feel bad for them. I feel really terrible for the like kids because it's just like, what kind? And I find adults particularly complicit because, you know, it's like you want to blame the younger generation. Well, it's like, well, who provided them with this education?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, why, you know, you gave them slop and you're like, well, they wanted slop. And I mean, ultimately.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's a very dangerous road to go down.
Unfortunately, it just, we are all enslaved by three tech companies and psychologically, and it's very hard to break out of it. You know, it's like how does something get known? You kind of almost now at this point, it has to be, they've made it so the real world, and that's kind of what I'm trying to create is something that's more, I mean, that's like my next plan for POW and just for everything I do. I want to create like live things in the world, like physical magazines and live shows and wheat pasting and like, you know what I mean? Like things exist in the physical world that aren't just this like digital nightmarish chimera. You know, that is like dependent on the algorithm and engagement. And the algorithm is dishonest. It favors dishonesty. It favors liars. It favors controversy for the sake of controversy. And of controversy for the sake of money, I should say. And that's the thing. It's like nobody, you know, we ran a really good essay by this writer named Salt LaCroix, who's actually, to be fair, she is really popular online. So props to her. But she wrote a great essay about Olivia Rodrigo and the controversy like, and I thought it was fantastic and it was smart. And, but of course, like, you know, the thing that would do the best is just like a scathing takedown, you know, I don't know if you ever read my Post Malone piece.
I haven't, but I know I saw it being referred to.
Yeah. Famously cruel. I don't really regret it, but like, that's how you go viral is just you write the meanest thing possible.
Yeah.
But I mean, what are you going to do that? Like, if you do that more than like once, twice in your career, you're like really have mental problems. You know what I mean? Like, you're like, well, I'm like, did someone not love you when you were a child? You know, to be that mean. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I think I'll only do it one more time for Little Dicky and that will be it. You know?
That's fair. Yeah, okay, but here's the thing is you, like, in terms of having to believe that other people are interested in this stuff, I feel like I'm in the position of like, all right, I got laid off of my job. This is me speaking as like, you know, 2 weeks ago, I got laid off of my job and I'm like applying for other work. And I'm like, okay, one tack would be like, oh, let's like put everything into the podcast and make it like my living. But there's just not I don't see a way to like guarantee to do that. And I'm not interested enough to like figure out some of the, I need enough time just to do the art of it.
Yeah.
But I know you actually are in the position of like setting in place some of the machinery of finding those people who are interested in this stuff and knowing like if it is actually sustainable. So for you, there's something a little more than hope. And does it exist as like how do the, not like the numbers work, but is there like a, are you like, okay, I know that at its peak, what I need is, or at its base even, I need this number of subscribers. And once we hit that, then these kinds of things will be possible. And then like, is it subscriber numbers? Is it a term? Is it in terms of like certain people coming and reaching out to you and being like, oh, we can make this live event possible because we want to collaborate with you in this way that doesn't feel gross to you and blah, blah, blah. Like how do you go from just like blindly believing that people are interested in the same things that you're interested in, want to put out, and like finding those people?
Well, in terms of the people that write for me, that's easy because like most of them I already kind of knew, or they came to me, or they, you know. In terms of, I mean, going back to what you're saying, I mean, yeah, like if we can get 2,000 people to subscribe, it'll be solvent. If we can get 5,000 people to subscribe, it'll be successful. And so, I mean, that to me seemed like difficult, but reasonable over time. I think it's just a matter of being able to hopefully like try to hustle up enough money and brand deals to survive until that point. Because that's really the challenge. It's you need money. It's
brand deals is like the like side thing, hustle thing.
Or some kind of like investment or something. You just need money. I don't have a trust fund. I'm not, you know what I mean? Like I'm not like spending billions, like, you know what I mean? I didn't grow up like poor or anything, but like this is not like some like, yeah, I have like $50 million in my trust fund and I'm just spending. Like it's real, and it's I'm scrambling, you know, I'm hustling. I don't know, I believe I didn't want to do this, but who, like, it's like everything I've ever done in my life that I have, like, not everything, but I mean, of course, like with books, like that was like, I was like, I have to write books. This is all I ever want to do. This is my dream. But like everything in terms of whether it was, you know, I led this like kind of boycott against the LA Weekly when they got bought by fascists in like 20, they probably were fascists, but they were a kind of like bumbling, idiotic kind of like slapstick fascists, which were kind of fun to kind of pot knock down. But and I started a magazine called The Land, and it was maybe ahead of its time. You know, it was a print magazine that was LA culture focused. So, I mean, there's kind of been a little bit of a print revival. I feel we were ahead of the curve, and we definitely were ahead of the curve in terms of these kind of like create your own, you know, like what Hellgate is doing, what Defector did, but like props to all those people for doing it. My friends are in San Francisco doing something called Coyote, which is sort of the same thing. I mean, but yeah, in terms of creating things, it's just like there's nothing out there. And that's kind of how I felt. And I looked around and I it became one of those things where I had to come to grips with the fact that it's like, why am I the only one doing this? Like, or not the only one, but like one of the few people left. Like, how did Fader and Vice and like BuzzFeed and like then Complex is like always in a state of disarray? They do publish good stuff sometimes, but all these, and I was like, well, fuck it, I have this website that I've been doing for a long time, and why not just take it to the next level and try to make it good and better, and then hopefully have a print publication and kind of fight against the machine, because somebody has to. Not to say like there are a lot of people, I mean, everyone who writes for me is helping, you know, everyone who edits for me does social media. It's you know, trying to build. I was inspired by like Wu-Tang when I was a kid, and I love the idea of a collective. And I just want, I just like desperately want things to be better, because I look on my screen and in the newspaper, and I'm just disgusted every day of my life, just constantly. So I read, you know, I like usually read old things. I try to burrow, you know, I listen, you know, someone asked me like the other day, they're like, how do you like keep up with stuff? And I was like, well, like, I mean, like I do listen to like all the new rap music that comes out, like when I'm at the gym, but like when I'm just trying to unwind, it's like all Grateful Dead and old jazz. I'm just like a full old man about that shit. And totally. I was like, I don't care. Like my brain is just sagging under the weight of 1,000 deadlines and financial pressures, and I'm just gonna just zone out and be like, actually this playing in the band from 1979 rocks. You know?
Yeah. Okay, then let me ask you the next tentpole question of the show.
Yeah,
Jeff, what's your coma? Do you understand the way in which I mean this? Like metaphorically, a dividing line where you can look back and say, this is one version of myself. This is the other version of myself. And this is where that transformation happened.
Definitely. And in fact, they are both about death. So, great. You know, so my first coma was when I was 20 years old and I was playing college baseball. I went to Occidental College and I had pledged a fraternity my freshman year when I was like 17 years old. And I didn't know what a fraternity really was. They were all on the baseball and football team. It was a small liberal arts college and they kind of recruited me in and thought it was, I liked to party and I liked girls. And I thought like it seemed to make sense for 12 minutes. And then these guys are kind of monsters and rapists and like, send me the and like bullies and deeply homoerotic in a way that they will probably never process.
But they go
to therapy for a lot of time. And there were like always like the five good guys that I was friends with that just were kind of like feckless and weak-willed. And
those are the good guys.
Yeah, and those were the good guys. And then I was like, well, fuck this. And I de-pledged, which obviously endeared me to them deeply, considering they were all on my baseball team. So they, of course, like had, but I was good. So they couldn't hate me that much because I was a starting DH pitcher, first baseman.
Oh, so starting DH. Okay, dude, you don't even need to be in the field to like impress them.
No, I could hit. Yeah, I was big lefty, didn't have much power. I actually did have a lot of power, but I just didn't know how to with a whole thing. But I had a high average. I never struck out. I was kind of like a Mark Grace, Will Clark. But I didn't do steroids, so I didn't end up making it. I could have gone a little further, I think, if I juiced. It was like a big juice era.
Okay.
I kind of regret it, honestly. I was like, it's been fine. But I was like, no, I have like its integrity and my morals and my body is a temple and I'm not going to juice. And I was I don't know.
There were other dudes juicing and you were like, man, you thought about it?
They were trying to get me to juice. Yeah, they're like, dude, just we stick the needle in each other's asses. It's sick. I was like, guys, this sounds awful. And again, years of therapy will not be able to unpack all the deep things that are going on inside your brain. Yeah, they all were juicing for sure. Like I was like the best player that was not juicing on my team. Like probably like the second best player on the team, but definitely the best player that wasn't juicing.
Yeah.
It was crazy. But then my junior year after I de-pledged the fraternity, I de-pledged, like I never was active. You know, I made it like right before Hell Week and they're like, Hell Week is next week. And I'm like, you guys can go fuck yourself.
Yeah,
I'm out.
Yeah.
But 2 years later, there were a bunch of guys on my baseball team who were freshmen and they ended up, almost all of them pledged. And, you know, of course I was like, I don't know. I wasn't like, you guys can't pledge. Cause like I'm on the baseball team with these guys. You can't be that much of a hardliner about it. But I gave my 2 cents, you know, it was like, I don't know. They all like, you're going to talk alike. You're going to walk alike. You're going to like, there were a lot of things that these guys did that was pretty despicable in the fraternity that, you know, not to like prematurely be like, I was always the good guy, but I wasn't a monster. At least I hope not. And these guys definitely had some monstrous qualities. And these kids got recruited into it. They did it. There was a Hell Week that year, you know, Hell Week every year. And there was a scavenger hunt to Las Vegas. And I don't think the driver was drunk, but I think they hadn't slept all week. And the driver of the car fell asleep coming home from Vegas at like 4 or 5 in the morning. Our starting shortstop was this really gifted freshman kid. He died. One of my best friends got thrown out of the car and had severe brain damage and he recovered, but it was very traumatic. Another guy was paralyzed for a couple years. Yeah, it was a really crazy, you know, and these were guys that I was all really good friends with. You know, the driver was also a freshman, but he only broke his arm. And I ended up, from that point on, I think I had done like mushrooms like the week before. And then, or I did mushrooms that semester. But after that, I just couldn't, like, there was like poems in my head that I couldn't get out of them. It felt like some kind of like spirit had possessed me. And
poems?
Yeah, I was writing like poems and words. So it's like I couldn't stop writing. And then I was like, oh, you are a writer. That's it. Like, you know, it was very much like after this death of my teammate, you know, I was possessed by the spirit to write. And then we had a team walk out later that semester. And you know, I never looked back from baseball after that. And I just became a writer. So that was like my real like first near death experience.
But what was the...
My first coma experience.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what was the like, what were the... Were the poems about your teammate, or was it like, how do you connect those things?
But then it just became like, you know, I mean, they were bad poems.
No, no, no. Yeah, yeah.
20-year-old's poems. But yeah, it just, there were words that just, you know, it was like whole like staves of poems that were just kind of flying into my head nonstop, like all the time. And
you before know, that, did you have any sort of writing practice?
Vague literary inclinations. But when I was young, I always remember, like, I read everything. You know, when I was a kid, like, I still... Like, to me, it's also why I'm so bitter about like the decline of literacy. I'm like, am I such a nerd that I think reading is awesome? Yeah. Like, I love reading. That is like one of my, like, there's nothing I enjoy more than reading. And I just look at these people and I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with you people? Do you have no interiority? Like, yeah. You're just stop. Anyways, but not to hate, but.
You can hate.
Yeah, I will. but. Of reading. Anyways, reading should be cool. Whatever. I don't know what's wrong with these people. And yeah, I always like saw the kids in the creative art. I mean, I was in like honor. I failed like the honors English test twice before getting in. And I wasn't exactly, no one was ever like, oh, he's going to be the next blah, blah, blah. But I always in the back of my mind knew that I could do it.
Yeah.
But I remember having the thought to myself when I was a young kid being like, if you're ever called to it, then do it. But if you're not called to it, then don't do it. I don't know why I had that thought in my head. I kind of knew it.
What does being called to it mean?
When he died, then yeah. I was called to it. You know, it felt okay. This is your some idea of a higher calling, which sounds pretentious, but I mean,
no,
whatever. Everyone wants some kind of higher calling.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm very lucky. And I mean, I don't know how, like, I'm trying to be as good as I can, but I definitely felt it. So, you know, it's my own personal truth, I suppose. And yeah, it was really just at that point, I never looked back. And then it just, my life was just very neatly cleaved into that section of my life. And then Draco getting murdered was the second one. And that happened, it'll be 5 years in December.
Yeah.
You know, at this point, I was very like, you know, deep into adult life.
So for folks who aren't even hip hop fans, give me the like full...
Yeah,
yeah. The spiel about
I've been able to elevator pitch everything at this point. A lot of podcasts, you know, a lot of meetings with Hollywood executives that are like, what are you talking about? But that went nowhere, but as they usually do. So basically Draco was a generational talent. Best way to think of him, if you don't know anything about rappers, he was a sort of like a young Tupac of the West Coast mixed with a little bit of like E-40 or Ghostface Killa, MF Doom, basically created his own language and slang that defined the sound of California. He rapped over a kind of music that he called nervous music that sort of transformed the aesthetic production choices of West Coast rappers. And additionally, his style was a pretty seismic break in terms of fashion and what he would rap about, like cars and jewelry. And he wasn't doing it in a way that was cliched. He was doing it in this very like flamboyant, colorful, vivid language. Mm-hmm. And I met him for the first time when he was in jail for a case that would end up being connected to a murder case that he would later be tried for. He ended up serving about 4 years and 3 years in jail, I guess 4 years total of his early 20s. And during these 4 years, I became really close friends with him and basically became the principal journalist that was covering his story and was able to kind of make him enough of a cause celeb where he got covered in the Atlantic and the New Yorker in addition to my own reporting. And we were able to kind of basically get him to the point where the DA was willing to cut him a plea deal after he'd already been acquitted of most of the most severe murder charges. There were a couple hung jury charges. And he came out of jail at the end of 2020. And then was murdered in December of 2021 at a festival. There's a civil lawsuit ongoing. The criminal case is still unsolved. And he was murdered right in front of me while we were walking to the show. And, you know, it's one of those things where I was like watching one of my best friends get murdered. And it's weird it was even weird to be like, oh, you know, you're just like some like journalist, you know, but we did get really close. It was, it was kind of like an odd couple, unlikely friendship. I mean, we would talk some weeks every night when he was in jail. You know, I think about it and I was like, I talked to this guy probably more than I've talked to anybody in my life outside of like, you know, the most intimate relationships that I've had, you know. And he was innocent, so I felt like a certain like moral duty to kind of help raise awareness. And, you know, I still feel that to kind of tell his story now, because he's not able to, you know, when he got out of jail the first time or the second time, technically, I kind of chilled out. Like, I mean, obviously I would cover his stuff and, you know, if he had an album, I'd do an Instagram post or something, but I wanted to let him be able to do his own thing and not me just be some kind of hanger on. But I, you know what I mean? I just like, it's kind of gross when people like attach their brand to somebody in a way feel just exploitive. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm trying to leech, you know, but now when after he got killed, it's sort of like, you know, his brother, Ralphie, who's a great rapper in his own right, you know, started saying, keep the truth alive. And yeah, like, I mean, I want to keep the truth alive. And, you know, I'm still like really close with his family, you know, like I'll spend Christmas there and, you know, Thanksgiving or whatever, you know, their Texas mom and Mother's Day, you know, but it's really, and I'm not saying this to like kind of like, it's such a weird topic that it's like you feel like almost like gross even mentioning these things.
Yeah,
so like,
yeah, I get you.
Take that with a grain of salt or whatever. I'm not, you know, but it just meant, it means, it like changed everything about the, like, I just know that there's evil in the world. You know what I mean? There's real evil in the world. And that is a fundamental, like, not like I didn't know it in the abstract, but I did. And like, it wasn't like the first time I'd ever dealt with something like, you know, but it was the most severe trauma of my life, you know, for sure. And you don't really recover from those things. I'm sure, like with your coma, it's like, you can't go back.
I mean, this shit happened 11 years ago. I'm still like doing the podcast about it. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, I'm like, yeah, like, I mean, I went to therapy. I mean, people are like, and then like people like, you know, people kind of with positive intentions will be like, how are you doing? Are you okay? And I'm like, I'm fine. Yeah. There are real people that, you know what I mean? Like, I have way more, like, extend your sympathy to Draco's mother and his family and his sister and his brother. And you know what I mean? Like, his son, the people that are really most acutely affected, because, you know, that is their direct blood. But yeah, he was such a special person and someone I loved very dearly. And to have gone through the entire experience of watching somebody be falsely incarcerated for years of their life, knowing that while, you know, of course, like, I don't know, his case was like, I could talk about it for a million years and it's like, don't down in it, but it was a really fucked up case. They were really prosecuting him under things that were very unjust and completely manipulating the law, and seeing the way that the criminal justice system can just destroy you if they want to. And then to watch him beat the case and, you know, come out and just become this great artist that, you know, he had done amazing stuff before, he did amazing stuff after. And then to see, just, you know, people can say whatever they want about why he died. There is just no excuse to, he was ambushed by 100 people, you know, slit his neck, they slit his throat, you know, and then just to watch him bleed to death on the concrete, you just don't recover from that.
Jesus.
So I guess I just like, Christ. It's a really, and like, I've been trying, you know, I'm trying to tell the story, whether it's a book or a documentary or ideally both. I've been working on trying to, you know, get it justice and hopefully like raise awareness so that there can be, I mean, Tupac's murderer is finally getting brought to justice 30 years later. So, I mean, there is hope for it, but I would like, I mean, I know his mother, I know, would like justice to be made. And yeah, so that I just can't look at the world the same way. And how it made me realize that, A, you know, God can turn off the lights at any time. And I guess B, someone like Draco, who, and I know that Draco must have thought he was invincible, because how could you not? Like, I think I'm invincible. You know what I mean? Death is like, that's the crazy thing. I think about death now constantly, partially because I'm older, partially because of that. Mm-hmm. And I just think about it constantly, and it just seems so insane to me, but it's the most sane, right? It's the only thing that you know will happen.
It's not personal.
It is the only thing that you can guarantee will happen to you in this life. And you're constantly trying to outrun it somehow. And to watch someone so full of life, so young, he was 28 years old, to just all of a sudden just gone. That made me realize even more acutely how precarious life is and how quickly it can be taken from you, and how one seemingly arbitrary decision in the moment can be, you know, the death of you. And
the decision being to walk the way that you guys walked, well, or
he could have left. I mean, in the instance of Draco, you know, he went out like Julius Caesar. It was basically he saw people that were his enemies.
Okay.
And there was a discussion in the car. It's all in my Los Angeles Magazine story. If you're interested, read. I've written a bunch of things about it, but the one I did a Los Angeles Magazine story in 20. Right after he got killed in beginning of 2022. And I also did a LA Times story from last year, kind of about his family kind of dealing with in the wake and kind of the legacy that he's had. And,
yeah.
So those would be the two I would just say. The Fader murder trial story is pretty crazy too, but that's like a whole like long read. So you have to really be invested in that one.
Yeah,
he could have left. He could have been a, you know, what he would have perceived as a coward. A lot of other people would have said, you were being smart, but unfortunately, you know, hip hop culture, street culture, more street culture than hip hop culture, because I think people often mistake the two, and there is a distinct difference. Although there is overlap as well, and street culture would have dictated that he couldn't be a coward. He couldn't walk away from, and he also couldn't walk away from a $50,000 paycheck. You know, that was waiting for him if he played. You know, he would have forfeited that and maybe got sued. But that decision ended up kind of costing him his life. It did. But I know he did it because he was Draco, and he must have thought that nothing could touch him. And honestly, I would have thought the same thing too.
Yeah.
But we're always wrong about death, you know, because we don't want to believe it's around the corner.
So how does this affect your, like, to if we're going with the aspect of it that's like a knowledge of evil and a, like, you know, consciousness around, like, there is evil in the world. How does that continue to show up for you now?
I mean, I think in my daily life, I don't see it every day, because I do think that it's something I probably have always known to some degree. I mean, even taking it back to this fraternity thing, right? I didn't think people were bad individually, but I think in groups they can be really evil. And okay. I think that's a big problem with humanity in general. It's once people get into groups and they have this like bully mentality and this, they're conformists. People by nature are very conformist. And that's something I learned early in college. And then it became this gang culture in general is a conformist thing. Like it's like the army, you know, it's like any organization. And Draco, to his credit, was like, this shit is lame. This shit is stupid. And like, I'm not disrespecting anyone in a gang, obviously, for safety reasons, but I get it. Like, I mean, I get it to some degree. I mean, obviously I don't get it. But I understand the wanting to belong to something bigger than you are. Like that makes sense to me. Like Wu-Tang, what I was saying, you know what I mean?
It's like the
idea of a collective is appealing and there is strength in numbers. And I think like that is, I mean, everything in life is like, you have to understand these opposite ideas, right? It's just like, that's the only way to trying to figure out life is the idea that both things can be right. And that's a really hard thing, I think, to grasp for most people. And I think the internet works against that. The internet is trash or classic, binary mentality. And that's not how life is, actually. Like, most things are mid. That's why it's mid, you know? Like, why the word comes, it's middle. It is an abbreviation. And, but in terms of, like, evil, how it manifests, it's like, it has made me want to, not like I needed any reminder, but it's like, try to be on the side of good. Try to conduct yourself with some kind of honor and self-respect. And like Draco, what would Draco do? That's the other thing about it. It's like, he became like a figure where I'm like, and I said this when he died, like 2 days after he died, you know, I think I wrote about this in the article, you know, super traumatized. I thought I'd had trauma, but I did not know what trauma is like. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, it, no disrespect to anyone that thinks they're going through trauma and it isn't. I mean, look, it's like whatever you make of it, Problems are real. But yeah, like when you deal with it, when you have that kind of thing where you're like, I mean, my brain felt like it was bleeding for weeks on end. Right. You know, I was like uncontrollably crying for weeks on end. And I'm not a crier. And I'm usually pretty good at handling like duress. And I had to speak. Like it was like the craziest thing, because it's like 2 days later, it's like at his house. Do you ever read The Great Gatsby?
Yeah.
You know, at the end of Gatsby, when Nick Carraway goes to his house with his father, and like his father's like, look, and like all, like he looks at, he sees all. I'd never been to Draco's house. We talked once on FaceTime. Mm. He'd only been there for like 3 or 4 months. I'd been to his previous place when he got out, and I hadn't been to his new place. He's like, you know, he was always like telling me you should come over. And I was like, yeah. But I was working my book and I was like out in the mountains, and he was like being Draco. So yeah. I never got a chance to go there. We only talked once on FaceTime, and he was like showing me the backyard. But it was just like powerful, because it's like you see this closet of his shirts, and like it was, you know, it just reminded me of Gatsby, where it's like he'd built this life in such a short time for all to be turned into dust, basically. And yeah, I had to speak at this like wake, and it was like, you know, his closest friends and family members. So it was like 35 or 40 of us, you know, and it was really tense, you know, because like people were worried of like retaliatory right. killings, or it was really an intense moment. And they're like, okay, Jeff, now you speak. And I was like, I think it was like maybe his brother spoke. I know his manager like at the time spoke for like a second, but it was like mainly me tasked to give this speech.
Cause you're the words guy.
I was being told I was going to prepare. You know what I mean? Like I traumatized. I don't know how well it went. People said it went well, but I whatever. I mean, I don't remember. But I do remember being like, the powerful thing about Draco was that you knew what he, like, how he would have lived his life. And like, you know, and like in terms, and I say this in terms of like to be like a guardian angel, like a spirit hovering above you, these ideas, these values. And not everything about Draco was perfect. I'm not gonna, you know, sure. he is a complicated man, but I'm more referring to his unwillingness to compromise, his fierce independent streak, his creative imagination, his courage, his ability to laugh in the darkest times, his unwillingness to suffer fools. And he said something to me once that always stuck with me about this. I was talking about some rapper that who I liked, you know, I thought he was pretty good. And he just looked at me and he goes, y'all are really settling for less. and I just think about it all the time. And it's like, don't settle for less, you know, and I try not to settle for less. And yeah, so in that respect, I mean, like that is also, that was my calm moment, because I now can only look at life through that lens.
Yeah. How does that, to do a little bit of a like, maybe it's a stretch, but maybe permit me the stretch.
Go for it.
What do you think he would, how do you use his memory or him as a guardian angel in this new era of POW Mag?
Yeah, I mean, it's strictly independent. You know what I mean? It's not suffering fools, hopefully. It's critical. It's trying to connect to the people. I mean, the slogan, you know, we know the truth is his slogan. The shirt that we're selling is inspired by him. You know, I don't want it to look like exploitive in any way.
Right,
I mean,
right.
I mean, that's like my guy. So it, you know, and everything, it's everything. It's the type of art that we'd ideally like to champion. I mean, I wish there was like another Draco. I mean, a lot of the rappers we have on the podcast are all like, I mean, almost everybody I have on the podcast, Draco influenced them in some way. Mm-hmm. Not everybody, but like a healthy portion, to the point of probably where like, if you were watching, you'd be like, oh, you're talking about Draco again. But I'm like,
sure,
you know,
sure,
I'm talking
sure.
about Draco till the day I die. Like, fuck you. Like that was my guy and he was taken from us. And like, I knew him as well as anybody outside of his family and maybe his girlfriend, you know, and like, so on some level, and his crew, like, you know, and like that, when you talk to somebody like hundreds of times on at the darkest moments of their life, like you become really close with them. And, you know, I say this not to like you know, again, like I know I keep on like, you know, I don't mean to kind of dismiss it or kind of like be too, you know, I don't mean to keep on backtracking about it, but it just meant so much to me, and he meant so much to me, and
yeah.
I have to, I feel, you know, when he died, I had another vision. I mean, I don't really talk about this much, so I mean, whatever, it's fine. Like, it's what it is. I think if you feel something, you should say it. But I had a vision when he died, and it was like, you're going to get everything you want, and you would trade it all in a heartbeat for him to be back. And this is before I knew he was dead. Like, this is like literally when I'm walking out of the festival after watching him get carried off in the ambulance, and the surrounding scene where there's police everywhere, and like, and I just had that thought, and I don't know, like I don't know, like I knew he was dead because I heard thunder. The concert hadn't even stopped yet, because like there were bands on stage when he was killed, and Funkadelic and Parliament Funkadelic and with George Clinton was playing Maggot Brain, you know, the Maggot Brain song.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you know how, like, you know, like George Clinton told Eddie Hazel, like, play like your mother just died.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
And I'm hearing this, I swear on like everything.
That
I'm
solo.
I heard the Eddie Hazel, not obviously Eddie Hazel's dead, but I heard whoever they have now playing that solo. And I knew Draco was dead.
Jesus.
And
Christ.
It was 3 hours before he was pronounced dead. You know, he was still technically alive when they brought him to the hospital, but I just knew he was dead. So I don't know. Like, I don't know. Like, these are the things that, you know, I don't know. I'm not trying to say I'm like some mystic or anything. You know, I find that kind of pretty, like, you know, oh, you're a mystic, but I don't know. There are things that you can't explain. Feelings and emotions that, you know, whether it's your brain doing it, but it's just like extrasensory in some way. And I feel like I've always had, and often with psychedelics has been like inspired that, but
sure.
But I've always, since I was like, not like since I was really young, but really since that first moment where like I had my coma moment where my friend died, like I felt like just sort of seen and felt things that I don't know, like, you know, and not like a crazy person or anything, you're not like, you know, just kind of like I was saying, like I've just felt things and had thoughts come into my head that felt like, you know, I don't know how I could have known them, but they usually turned out to be true.
Yeah. Well, and when you talk about like his family sort of still wanting justice and you observing, you know, the other thing that this podcast is like kind of a lefty podcast, like just whenever it, you know, that stuff happens to be. So you know, I'm coming from a place of like kind of no prison or police system is really valid at any point. That sort of abolitionist lens, to use the overused word. But I also recognize that some people who've had harm done to them, like, want the exact same kind of harm done to someone else. But how does it affect how has like seeing all of this and going through all of this affect your view of the criminal legal system in America?
I mean, that's the thing, right? Like, if you believe that evil is real, like, I don't, like, in general, yeah, like, I'm not a fan of the police. And, like, if you read those stories, it's, like, pretty clear. Yeah. Like, there are definitely police officers that, like, definitely have me on a voodoo doll, you know? Mm-hmm. But, like, you know, the Billy Madison, like, list of people to kill, you know? And at the same time, like, and this is something that, like, yeah, like, I mean, I consider myself a creature of the left as well, but there is evil in the world. And, like, there has to be a system. And, like, no matter, like, we would have figured it out by now. And I'm not saying the opposite is true, because, like, obviously the criminal justice system is so fucked up. And having seen that side of it, it's just appalling and gross. And, you know, of course, watching that, then your mind is like, well, everyone should be free. But then you're like, well, what happens when your friend gets killed? You know what I mean? It's like,
and
one
I'm
of
not
things.
Coming from a place of judgment. I just want to know what no, like, no, and no, no purity true. Test about like, oh, who, you no, know, yeah, real, yeah. whatever. I'm just curious where your head's at with it. Like,
I would like, I mean, look, for me, it's like his mom. You know, I think his mom would like to see justice. So therefore, I would like to see justice.
And what would that also look like?
I mean, I don't know. Look, like, I'm not going to talk about it too, like, you can, sure, but like, sure, there sure. are videos that have been made, like, online where you, if people are interested in searching about who the killer is, like, you can find them. And one of the people that is insinuated in the killing is a very famous rapper from Los Angeles. And it is very difficult to see that kind of stuff where, you're, whether it's true or not, again, this is not my place to speculate, and I certainly wouldn't do it on a podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's hard to watch, you know, if that is to be true. You know what I mean? If you believe the thing, and I would like his family to have closure. I think that's I believe in closure. Some people don't believe in closure. I believe in closure. But I also, like, I believe in, like, you know, going to a cemetery and, like, talking to the gravesite, you know, even though I know that no words are coming back from me, you know, I believe that's a powerful human impulse. So, yeah, I mean, I think his brother would probably have a different concept of what that looks like. You know, everyone has their own perspective on it. For me, I mean, it's like, I Draco's mother is like, you know, she's like family to me, and she said that to me, and, you know, so I want her to kind of, I want them to get also, I mean, in terms of a civil, there's a big wrongful death case. I mean, I would like taken care of, you know, and that is also something in the criminal justice system. I mean, obviously it's the civil side, but there is a, you know, it's like they're fighting this billion-dollar corporation, you know, for wrongful death, because, and their son would have made probably $50 or $60 million over the course of his career.
Right.
You know, that's an insane amount of money. He was taking care of his mother. So yeah, I would like that to, you know, I would like her to have the peace, because she deserves it. She's a wonderful woman, and she's been through an unbelievable amount of suffering that no mother should ever have to deal with. So I like, for me, like, my version of happiness is seeing her happy and taken care of and financially remunerated for her loss.
Yeah. So let's talk about happiness potentially in my sort of last tentpole question here, which has, I don't think I told you this, that Open Mike Eagle broke this fucking question for me. Like, he's smart. Great. And he was my 200th episode guest, right, just coincidentally. But he, I used to ask people for a memory that they would choose to relive if that were a feature of the afterlife whenever they wanted. Yeah. And he kind of correctly pointed out a thing that had never really sat right with me, which is like, okay, well, are you aware you're reliving it? Are you the same person? You know? And I was like, you know what? Fair enough, dude. We're forget the whole, like, that concept of it. I want to know about a time when you were aware of living, like, one of the capital T times of your life, where you're like, yo, this is, I am fucking in it right now.
Yeah. I mean, it happened to me last year. You know, this book, Waiting for Britney Spears, I dreamed about writing it for almost 20 years, or probably 20 years at that point. I mean, from the, when the name came up to when it was published, it was 20 years, you know, and the book is about, you know, for those who it's basically a very fictionalized account of a celebrity journalist based on me, but he is nameless, covering Britney Spears from her rise to her fall and using her as kind of a symbol of the death of the American dream. And I was in New York, which to me is always, you know, I'm an LA guy. I'm like born and raised LA. I'm like third generation LA. New York is always kind of my grandparents. My dad's dad was from there. And my dad's mom was from there, and they came over in the 50s. And, you know, my great grandparents, I think on my mom's side, grew up in New York until they moved to Chicago and then LA. So, I mean, it's always been this place of the imagination. Of course, if you're a writer, New York is sort of the, you know, my grandfather once said that to me. He lived there until his 30s and he moved to LA. And he was like, New York was, is, and always will be the place. I don't know if that's true, but
sure.
New York is like, it has some energy to it. And I did a reading out there, and it was basically sold out. It was packed. And I threw this party, and, you know, with friends and afterwards, and a bunch of people that I really cared about and loved were there. And, you know, I had enough money to pay for them, or at least pay for the first part of it. It was expensive, but I paid for like the first, like, several rounds, you know?
Yeah.
And then I was in a car the next day, and I got word that the book, you know, debuted at number 6 in the LA Times charts for nonfiction bestsellers. And, you know, it was just it. Like I was in a cab and I just was like, it'll never get better. You know, I was young enough where I had my health and my parents were alive and my grandmother had gotten, I mean, that was the other thing. My grandmother, who the book is dedicated to, had got to come to my LA reading like the week before. And I thought she was not going to make it to the end of the book coming out. And all I wanted to do was get her to hear this book. She can't read anymore. She's blind, but she can hear the audiobook. And I got to that point and it debuted on the charts. And, you know, obviously like you have to divorce yourself somewhat from commercial success because I think it's a false metric.
Yeah.
But it was the LA and you know, obviously New York would have meant that so more.
Sure.
But it's fine. Like I'm an LA guy. So, you know, and I grew up reading the LA Times every day. I didn't grow up reading the New York Times. So I remember being in my early 20s and just looking at the LA Times bestseller list and being like, fuck all this shit. Like, when is it going to be you? Like, you know, you could do this. These books look stupid. I don't want to read them.
Yeah.
I don't want to read any of this shit. Who's buying this? Hey, and look, it was just like a week, you know, it wasn't on the charts the second week, but it was there that first week.
Yeah.
And this was that moment. And, you know, I was on my way after that to London for a story that I, you know, got paid for. Like, and then, you know, I was gonna have a reading in London. And it just, I was like, this is like your dream. You got your dream. And I guess I think that was the culmination of the Draco thing. It's like, you're gonna get your dream. And like, the other dream, of course, was like, now it's like, now, well, me and Draco, I talked about doing a documentary, you know, and we filmed some stuff. So the goal, you know, that was always our plan, you know, and to the point of where at one point before his like third trial, there was this woman that came aboard and she was a lawyer and she said that she would do the trial, but Draco would have to let her do a documentary with her.
Okay.
Which is like totally unethical and she should have been disbarred for. But Draco was like, no, I'm doing the documentary with Jeff. And so Draco was willing to risk potentially going to jail forever.
Yeah.
Because he had made his work. He had, you know, and if he said that to me, like, I have to do this, I would have been like, I get it, man. Like, I totally get it. And he was willing to do that. So again, like, it goes back to like the morals and integrity of Draco. You know, he was willing to sacrifice it all for his friend. He had that level of loyalty. And so, yeah, I think that was like getting to live my dream. And then, you know, it's the last 8 months since I got off the book tour in October. So it's been like 7 months. And, you know, I guess the second part of that was I finished my book tour in Tampa, St. Petersburg. And
classic. You got to end in Tampa, dude. That's the place.
Yeah. It was great. No, it was honestly great. I read with this Caroline Calloway and we sold out this place.
Okay.
Book packed. And yeah, the two of the last three readings were like the best ones I'd done. You know, wow, I had one in Toronto and like I worked with these like promoters who were fantastic and we sold out. Oh, wait, I don't know if we sold out, but there were like 120 people in this hotel and people bought tickets and I had this great reading and then went to Tampa and then they put me on the cover of the Tampa St. Petersburg Alt Weekly and hell, I grew up in Alt Weeklys.
Yeah, dude. And they that rules.
And,
they put me
there, and it was just the it just I wanted to I'm not like again like I've never cried from happiness like I don't have that emotion like but I would have cried from happiness.
Yeah,
like I don't understand the people that have the like the thing where you cry from happiness. Like maybe I'm defective in that way because I've never cried from happiness. Like I just get happy. And then the writer of the story that ended up being in the cover was like, are you gonna stay at Jack Kerouac's house in St. Petersburg? And I was like, there's a Jack Kerouac house in St. Petersburg, Florida? And he's like, yeah. And he's like, I'll link you with the owner. And there was this really cool former college professor who'd bought a house in retirement and the Kerouac house. And he would rent it out to people and they'd throw events there. And like for like $250, you could spend the night at the Jack Kerouac house. And then I'm just like sitting there at the end of my tour and I spending the night there. And, you know, he was like, I like Kerouac. I mean, I loved Kerouac at one point. I have a more complicated relationship as I've gotten older, but I still think his best work is really great and valid. And I wish people didn't disrespect the bad. People use the bad work to negate the good work, but like there's a lot of good work too. And I was just there and, you know, I'm like, I did it. And I was just so happy. And then of course, like your brain doesn't work like that because then the next thought was my brain was being like, well, your dream, like you climbed the mountain and you didn't get to the top of the mountain. Like, you know what I mean? You didn't get a Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah.
You're not like 30 weeks on the New York bestseller list. Right. You're not at the top of the mountain. but you're at the plateau leading up to the top of the mountain, you know, maybe like a couple miles, dozen miles below. But you can see the top of the mountain. And then I like saw the top of the mountain and I'm like, oh, it's a glacier. And I've been hiking up a glacier that I thought was a mountain and it's all melting. And that has been my last like 6 months trying to reconcile that idea, that reality or my perceived reality with the life of a writer, the life of an artist, the life of a whatever, creative person. And trying to see how that makes sense and how I can survive, you know, because like, I mean, I just at the end of the day, I hate having to talk about money. It's so gross. Yeah. And you know, it's I really believe in the Quincy Jones line where he's like, when you think about money, when you're making art, God walks out the room. Mm-hmm. And I do think like that's the case. And but yeah, it's just hard to kind of, you know, you want to like have a family. I mean, I don't know if you have a family or whatever, but you know,
a partner and a cat. That's the family at the moment, you know?
The cat's over there. She's old. She's sleeping.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have a family. I'd like one probably at some point. But I would like to be able to, I, you know, I don't know. Maybe I'm like a hopeless romantic in some way, but I'd like to be able to like have a child and like, or two and raise them well and pass on like something to fight against the chaos and anarchy and have, you know, hopefully they turn out all right and not like some, you know, Gen A monster. You know what I mean? You're like, oh,
yeah,
you raised a monster. Like they have Gen A stare and it's just like.
Right. Who knows what the stare is at that point?
Yeah, it's just hard. You know, I'm sorry you had to deal with your own like thing with your the job and everything, but it's a good grind. You know what I mean? It's a grind. I just
when you say it's a glacier, you mean the network, like the particular American dream of, oh, I can make a living being an artist or being a writer. Yeah. That's the thing that's melting.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you're going to be F. Scott Fitzgerald like, or whatever.
Sure. You know? And like for me, the way that I'm like retroactively kind of, cause I'm just like, I'm constantly rethinking about this. And honestly, the reason I talk about it in this meta way on the podcast so much is cause this is where I do a lot of the thinking about it. But a lot of it is being like, oh, dude, my favorite record is Double Nickels on the Dime.
Great record.
What made me think that the guy who did improv in the early 21st century, whose favorite album was Double Nickels on the Dime, was like ever destined to like be fucking huge at something? It's like, dude, what you've always wanted is maybe not the glacier. Is like some, maybe not even the plateau, maybe some weird outcropping from the plateau. You know what I mean?
For sure. I mean, I guess like I always kind of liked popular shit.
Yeah,
like that's like the funny thing about me is I feel like all of my inspirations are very popular.
And I do too. I don't mean to be like pretentious, like I'm only a heady sort of whatever.
No, totally. I mean, I love the underground shit too, but like I feel like my goal, now that I'm old, like Draco, I think was like that. Maybe that, you know, like Draco was like the ultimate, if you know, you know. But at the, you know, he got a Nas cosign after he died.
Right.
Stuff like that. Or like MF Doom or something.
Sure.
Or, I mean, like Kerouac. Well, that was the other thing that was comforting about Kerouac was knowing that he died broke and kind of disrespected. And, you know, he wrote something that, but I do think that, I mean, whatever, that's a whole like wandering digression about like literature and like, the fact that men don't read, you know,
right.
But well, like that's like my whole cross to bear is like I just wish men would read, which is amazing that women read, and I'm really happy that women read.
Yeah, definitely.
But like also, I think our world would be much better if men read fiction and like not just like the 10,000 men that live in New York that read fiction.
I totally agree. You need a pen name that's like some misspelling of Jordan Peterson. And then like people think they're reading a Jordan Peterson book and it's like, oh shit, dude. And you've accidentally opened them up, you know?
A dipshit. Like clean your room. You're like, great, but clean your room. Or thanks, mom. Like, whatever. Like, such an asshole, that guy. Oh my God.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, how are these guys on Janet's going?
I know. So I guess, I mean, we've got there. We've landed. The only things that I am curious from you is A, if there's anything that I've cut you off from that you're like, well, dude, I had a little bit more in the tank on this. I wanted to keep going.
No, I mean, I feel like I've rambled sufficiently. We could talk about other shit, but I think it's probably not germane to the podcast. I think if I was listening to me talk, I'd be like, I don't know, it's like an hour and a half in. Shut this shit off, Weiss.
Well, you know? My other thing is I want you to plug whatever you want to plug. But before that, for folks who have no familiarity, what is the first Draco record to listen to?
Oh, go to Cool Devil. It's like amazing.
Okay.
It's the best record. I mean, it's like Rolling Stone named it to their best 100 rap albums ever. But I think it's a perfect, it's the great West Coast rap album of the 2010s. I mean, I guess you could probably say Kendrick Lamar, Good Kid, Mad City. But those would probably be like the two for me.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
So where do you want people to find your work? I mean, you know, we've talked about the stuff that I'm gonna link.
Subscribe, pay for the POW Mag Substack. We need people to pay so I can survive. I'm not even making money off of it right now. Like, I'm just like, it's literally going to writers and editors. Like 100% of it, I'm like making like maybe minimum wage off of it, if that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really like trying. It's not a pyramid scheme to make a bunch of money off music journalism. Like, I really need people to subscribe and understand that I know I hate, like breaking the fourth wall. Guys, I hate paying for shit too. I don't want to pay for anything.
I know.
But please pay for it, because it's like you are supporting good work and the writers need money. And I'm still not paying the writers nearly enough money. And I wish I could. I would love to pay people like what they deserve. That would be like my dream. That is like one of my real dreams, is like I can pay a writer at least $700 for an essay. That would make me feel really happy. Mm-hmm. And like probably they deserve $4,000 for that essay. But like if I could pay them between $500, and I am so far from that. And I would love to be able to do that, because I think writers deserve money for their craft and their time. You know, we have a pretty popping Instagram if you like things for free, POW Mag. I'm Passion Weiss on all socials. I'm out here doing my thing, trying to abide, you know, just like that other great Jeffrey, you know, not the bad Lebowski, but like the good Lebowski.
Yeah.
He's the only good Jeff left.
Yeah.
You know, it's me, Young Thug, and Jeff Lebowski. Epstein really did not do good numbers for the Jeffs.
Yeah, like, that is real.
Really took us down for a couple generations, mm-hmm, I feel. Mm-hmm. No more Jeffs. So beyond the evil stuff that he did, I also hate him for ruining the name. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you get to, I mean,
bad work for Jeff.
Throw like, another thing on the pile, dude. I mean, yeah.
I know, just like everyone. So one thing they like don't mention. They're like, well, yeah, I'm like, yeah, I agree with you about the monstrous stuff, but also Jeff's. I'm like, dude, that's not what you focus on.
They're like, what's that be? Priority 999 is how he affects Jeff's. Well, yeah. I really like the magazine. There's so much good work that I subscribed when I saw the manifesto. Yeah. I can't keep up with it.
And, that's too much, right?
Well, but no, here's the thing I'll say for folks who are like, because weirdly, This Is Your Afterlife has, 2026 has been a weirdly rap heavy year for the podcast.
Yeah.
Which doesn't even reflect my listening habits that much. But even if you're not a rap aficionado, like you said, there's the Olivia Rodrigo piece.
Yeah, like this week, you know, we had a piece on like Run DMC at 40, Raising Hell at 40. We had a piece on Olivia Rodrigo and just like a kind of analysis of kind of how aesthetics and these cello things have taken over the discourse.
Yeah,
we had a tribute to Ryan Porter, who is this legendary LA jazz man that tragically died at 46 like this last week. And we had Sophie Kemp, who's like an amazing novelist, wrote a like a meditation about this folk artist named Aldous Harding.
Yes, that she really liked. That was great. I really liked that.
And then we also have like the best new rap songs of the week, you know. So, and then there's like one thing that I'm like forgetting. And then like next week we're gonna have, by the time this airs, we'll have had an article. There was a kid that got a young artist born in Kenya who was snatched up by ICE in Portland, lives in LA for a long time. And yeah, and one of his best friends and collaborators, who's also a fantastic writer named Reese Langston, who was just on tour with Mike Eagle.
Dude, I just talked to him when he opened for Mike Eagle, and I'm in the process of getting him on the podcast. Yeah,
my record label put out a bunch of records with Reese. He's the best, like a dear friend and a real genius.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, POW recordings also. You can listen to the it's on the POWMag.net website if you guys are still listening to this. But
they
yeah,
are,
you
they
know,
have to be because I need them also to know that I also, you know, I've admitted I'm not trying to make a living out of this, but
subscribe to the Patreon.
Subscribe to the Patreon, you guys. Patreon.com/thisisyourafterlife. $5 a month gets you the premium feed. There's bonus episodes on the off weeks. Last week was the first episode of a sort of pilot podcast with my friend Sarah Nattel about nasty squeezes. And if you're curious what that concept is, you got to listen to the Patreon episode. $15 a month are the producers, and they get shouted out every episode. Those people are Katie Llewellyn, Fred Fidowa, Shubha Singh, G. Debo, and Doc Lobster, MD. Thank you, Jeff, for doing the show.
Thank you for having this. What a pleasure. This is great.
Thanks to Matt Sage for the show's art, and This Is Your Afterlife house band, Lake Mary, for the music. Follow on Instagram. Go to thisisyourafterlife.com for all the links to everything you need. And I would genuinely love to hear from you. If you have anything to say, just fucking say it to my face, you know, at thisisyourafterlifepodcast@gmail.com. And until next time, remember, you are a mist.